Hello and welcome to episode 93 of our podcast, Two Chairs Talking. My name is David Grigg and I'm joined as always by my sparkling co-host, Perry Middlemiss. How's tricks, Perry?
Not bad. I'm not terribly sure I'm sparkling terribly
sparkling. You don't feel sparkling? Never mind.
Cricket's been on. I've been sitting up watching the test cricket from England and...
You could have been drinking some sparkling wine during the course of that.
Not sparkling wine that late at night. You know, maybe a whiskey or a fortified musket or something along those lines just to keep myself warm.
Very good.
That's been very interesting. But we had a podcast that talks about sport very much, David. So,
well, that's because I have no interest whatsoever in sports.
I sort of gathered that, which is why I don't talk about it very much
which
at
is
all.
Right, indeed, yeah.
Which is probably a very good thing.
Indeed.
So what about you? Are you sparkling?
Speaking of sparkling, we did have some champagne yesterday.
Oh, okay.
Yesterday we had our family Christmas get together.
Christmas in July.
It was very pleasant indeed. We had some mulled wine, which was very nice indeed.
Ooh, okay.
Warm wine with cinnamon and orange and things in it. It was very nice indeed. I could have drunk a lot of that, but apparently it's fairly potent, so you have to stay clear of that. And we had ham and we had turkey wings and we had all sorts of goodies, roast potatoes. It was very nice indeed. And a crackling fire. My daughter and son-in-law have got this stove it's just sort of blazing away with the flames. It was wonderful.
Yep, it is good.
He's the one who was taking a great deal of the wood from our property after the chopping down of the trees.
Okay.
He'll have to just put it aside for a couple of years before he can use it, but he's got quite a bit which he's already had put aside. And so, yes, he was blazing up the fire. It was very nice.
Oh, yes, well, you can get some really lovely days. And this time of year when it's been a little bit cold, it's said to be not quite as cold the last few days, but we had a fairly cold burst about a week or a fortnight ago. So I was freezing for a few days.
It's been pretty cold.
Oh yeah, not the best. So having the idea of that sort of big Christmas roast of everything in July is really an excellent way of doing it.
We had everything. We had a Christmas tree. We had Christmas carols sung. And it was
really went whole hog. I just thought we'd just have the meal and
the thing is
off to bed at 3 in the afternoon or something.
No one knows what day of the year Jesus of Nazareth was born.
No.
So any day is as good as any other to celebrate it.
I think we're all pretty assured that 25th of December is a date that was chosen to, overwrite pagan festivals of around that time.
It's one thought at least, yes.
Yes, and I think that being given as it's so close to the shortest day of the year in the Northern Hemisphere, I think that that's probably the reason why it was done. As an idea that it's a birth of a new year.
That's
so
right, very much so, indeed.
As the sun turns around and passes its furthest spot from the Earth and comes back again. The sun's not doing that. The Earth's doing it, really, isn't it?
Where the axis points.
Yep.
Which comes up later, actually, but never mind.
Oh, okay.
We'll discuss that. Yeah. All right. Now, do we have any news?
Oh, yes. We've got a lot of news.
Oh, gee. You're the news expert.
Oh, yes. Okay. Well, the most interesting thing of the whole lot, of course, is that, as I mentioned last time in our last episode, that we were promised the 2023 Hugo Awards ballot by the end of June. And here it is in July with no final ballot yet released. Maybe. Actually, there was a list of the nominees that appeared on the Chengdu website. That's the city that's holding the convention this year in China. It was up there this morning for a very short period of time. I would say probably about 15, 20 minutes. Oddly enough, I found it in those 15 or 20 minutes. And I was able to have a look. I thought, here it is. So I basically sort of copied down all the major stuff that I wanted to copy. And I thought, right, okay, I'll talk about that. Went to go back and have a look at another category. Oh, something's wrong here. The website's down for updating. It is still down for updating, David. Yeah. And that is sort of 4 or 5 hours later. The story is that the lists were put up in error. They were supposed to have been used as a test and actually got put up through to their production site. So they were hastily removed. And while I have that list of the original nominees, I'm not going to discuss them.
No, that's fair enough.
All because I think it's not fair on them, nor is it fair on anybody else.
Hmm.
And I think we shall just wait for the official one.
Yeah, but yeah,
I was hoping you'd be able to come out here and say, so the nominees for the best Hugo novel are... And then off we go.
Okay, well, never mind. No, that's very interesting.
Okay, so anyway, there are some interesting things. If it stays that way, I believe that the problem is that they are waiting on one fiction category to be finalised, which I'm not sure if people are aware of this, but basically what happens, you would know because you did this, David, way back in 1975, and it was probably a lot harder then. What happens now is that the nominations come in, they're all tallied up, and the top six in each category, the authors or producers or creators or whoever is responsible for those top six nominees in each category is contacted and asked if they would like to appear on the ballot, because, of course, it is quite possible for people to withdraw if they have been nominated because it's their choice. Sometimes this happens because, well, people have said, look, I've won too many of them. I don't think it's fair. I think we need to go to somebody else. Or, no, I don't think my story is good enough and I don't think it should be there. Or I've actually got two stories on the ballot and I don't want to split the vote, so I'll withdraw one of them. Any of those reasons are legitimate and none of those reasons are ever publicised, nor is the fact that somebody actually withdrew. It is up to the creator to say so. The Hugo administrators who run the awards each year will not say who withdrew until you can sort of figure it out when all the votes come in after the award ceremony, because they put out all the votes counts and they also put out all of the nomination counts, and you can say... They say there that a certain person has, this story was withdrawn. That's it. They don't say why, and neither they should. It's up to the creator to determine whether they want it to be on the ballot or not, if they are being invited to be, and nobody says they have to be, and they don't have to give a reason. So that's it. So I think they're in a situation where they are attempting to contact one or two people who have not responded. And they're so close to getting there when you consider they've got about 140 people to contact, and with one or two people holding out, it's holding out everybody else. Now, it might just be that, you know, the people are on holidays and don't actually have contact. So that's really difficult sometimes when you're trying to do it in a hurry.
Mm.
Although China is taking a bit of time to get this together.
No, that's all right. It's their first time.
It is their first time, and I'm not going to criticise them for it at all. It's just that it is a difficult process that needs to be worked through, and they are working through it. And that's all we can do, and we can just sit back and wait. But you can pretty much get a bit of an idea of what sort of stuff is going to be on the ballot if you wanted to start reading, because you read the other award winners for the year. We've already discussed the Nebula Awards, which were handed out a month or two back. And the other one that's been awarded just recently, or presented just recently, on June the 24th, in fact, were the Locus Awards. Now, these are the awards that are given out by the Locus magazine, generally based on the recommendations that come out in the February issue of Locus magazine, but not necessarily, because it's open for voting for just about anybody, I believe. And anyway, so I can give you the top levels. Now, don't forget that with the Hugo Award, you get best novel, best novella, best novelette, best short story in the top four fiction categories. In the Locus Award, you get best science fiction novel, best fantasy novel, best horror novel, best young adult novel, and first novel.
Mm.
So first novel is considered to be its own category. But the first novel can be science fiction, horror, young adult, fantasy, any of them.
It's a strange way of doing it, really.
It is a strange way of doing it, but they've done it this way for a long period of time, and they just stick to it with the idea that this helps to elevate the first novelists, if you like. And you know, I could see the perspective.
Yeah, but other awards do both. You can actually be winning both categories.
You could, but they don't. They don't allow that. If you're in the first novel category, you can't be in any of the others. I don't know. Maybe we could talk to somebody at some stage and say, please explain, but that's just the way they do it. Anyway, so I can give you the winners for the top categories.
Sure.
Science fiction novel was won by the Keiju Preservation Society by John Scousy. Fantasy novel, Babel by R.F. Kuang, which you really enjoyed. Horror novel, What Moves the Dead by T. Kingfisher. The young adult novel, Dreams Bigger Than Heartbreak by Charlie Jane Anders. First novel, The Mountain in the Sea, which you and I really both enjoyed. Mountain in the Sea was on my Hugo nomination ballot. The novella was won by A Prayer for the Crown Shy. Didn't like it. Didn't like it at all. Gave it a very low rating when I read this. Novelette, If You Find Yourself Speaking to God, Address God with the Informal You by John Chu. Don't know that one, but I believe it did very well in the Nebulas as well. And the short story, Rabbit Test by Samantha Mills. Now, generally, you would think that a number of these will appear on the Hugo ballot because there's a sort of fairly good correlation between what happens with the Locus Awards and the Hugo Awards. Not perfect, but you get a bit of an idea about what's going on. And so if you wanted to do some pre-reading, I would suggest that you read the... certainly, if you wanted to get in front, I'd be reading the Scousy and the Kuang. Absolutely. And possibly the Naylor, and possibly the Becky Chambers novella. She always seems to appear on the Hugo ballot. So to my everlasting confusion, she always seems to appear. But there we are. People like her stuff. So, and that's what it is. It's a popularity contest, isn't it, David? It's just the way that it is. So that's the last of the awards that I've got. The only other piece of news I have is the death of Cormac McCarthy, who wrote The Road, which won the Pulitzer Prize. He died within the last month. He was 89 years old. And The Road will actually get a mention a little bit later on in this particular program, which is funny enough. So people, if you haven't read The Road, it's probably a very good idea to do so. It's a fairly harrowing post-apocalyptic story about a man and his son trying to travel from across a desolated landscape filled with bandits and cannibals, trying to get from one part of the country to another. It's quite a tough little novel to read, but sparse but quite excellent. So a very, very good novel indeed. But that's the last of my news, David. I don't have anything else.
Yeah, no, nothing here. I don't have anything.
All right. Okay. All right. Well, in that case,
we'll move along.
And we'll move along to our major part of today's episode,
which is the Hugo Time Machine.
And we go back to the vastly distant past, to 1970 for the Hugos. Now, 1970 Hugos were those that were awarded to works that were published or first appeared in 1969. Almost first appeared in 1969.
Yeah, yes, it's a caveat, isn't it?
There's a few little funny things there, but we'll get to that. Now, the 1970 Hugos were handed out at the 28th World Science Fiction Convention, HiCon 70, held in Heidelberg, Germany, between the 20th and 24th of August 1970. Now, this was the very first Worldcon to be held on mainland Europe. And I think it was probably the first Worldcon to be held outside of the US, Canada, and the UK. I think Aussiecon in 75 was the second, and then it started to move a lot more and become much more the world science fiction convention as opposed to, you know, North American or Northern Hemisphere science fiction convention. So anyway.
Certainly was the first Worldcon held in a non-English speaking country, or yes, majority non-English speaking country.
So it actually was a few firsts. First one in mainland Europe and the first one in a non-English speaking country. Good point. Now, the pro guest of honour was, there were two, E.C. Tubb from the United Kingdom, mainly known for his Dumerest series of science fiction adventure novels. Robert Silverberg from the USA, still kicking, but he's not writing anymore. Although I was on a, I'm on a mailing list on which he's on, and he said just recently that he has sold a new story to somebody, three sentences long, three, a grand total of three. One of them he's copied from another author, which he's given the credit to. One is a sort of pastiche of that author, another sentence by that author, and the last one is his own sentence. So he said he's written one sentence. So because he's basically retired, he's well into his late 80s, and he's done. So anyway, so as I said, the pro guests of honours, E.C. Tubb, Robert Silverberg, and Herbert W. Frank from Germany. The fan guest of honour was Elliot K. Shorter, who was the TAF winner, and the Toastmaster was John Brunner from the United Kingdom. Attendance was approximately 620 people. So that's not bad for that time. That time it was, that was pretty good. I think Aussiecon got 750
sounds about right. Yeah,
about that amount. So that was pretty good. Now, we've been mentioning over the journey with these Hugo time machines that the categories for the Hugo Awards have been going sort of in and out. There's always been the novel, and there's always been the novella. The short story one is sometimes short story and novelette, and sometimes just short story, which covers short stories and novelettes. Well, very soon after the 1970 Hugo's, it did settle down to the four categories and has stayed that way ever since, which aligns it with the Nebulas. But in 1970, they had Best Novel, Best Novella, and Best Short Story. And Best Short Story was everything that was short that wasn't a novella. So all of the novelettes and all of the short stories. So we will identify which one's which as we go through and as we talk about them, David.
Indeed.
Right, well, we'll start with the short stories. And the first of the ones that was nominated, these are basically done in, let me see, yes, I've done these in order of the author's surname. So this is not an indication of where they appeared, how they appeared after the voting. I wasn't really interested in that. I would just put them in order of surname. The first of these is Deeper Than the Darkness by Gregory Benford, who was our 1999 guest of honour at Aussiecon 3. This was a novelette out of fantasy and science fiction from April 1969. And this is an interesting story about Earth's expanding space empire running up against some aliens who have a certain way of... overpowering other alien races, which happened to be the humans in this instance. It looks at an interesting story and worth reading. I thought it was pretty good. Winter's King is the next one by Ursula K. Le Guin. This is from Orbit 5, and it's a short story. Now, this is a story as part of the author's Hainish cycle. It deals with the effects of human lifespans of near light speed. And it is actually set mostly on the planet Gethin, or Winter, which is where the Left Hand of Darkness is also set. Remember that novel's name for a bit later on. And it was written about a year before the novel. It's really quite an excellent little story. And you can really see her starting to expand rapidly here in terms of her writing technique.
Hmm.
The next one is Not Long Before the End by Larry Niven, fantasy and science fiction. Short story. Now, this is part of his fantasy short story, which features a warlock who discovers that magic is a non-renewable resource, which is why there's no magic around now, because it's all been used up.
Clever idea.
Clever idea. Once it's used up in one particular area by a particular magician, it's gone for good and you can't actually replace it. And this is a very, very interesting story about how this warlock is attacked by a swordsman, and he's able to utilize the fact that magic in a particular area is diminished as a defense against this particular swordsman, and he does it in a very clever way. Now, this is a prequel to Niven's novel The Magic Goes Away, and looks competent and amusing, and a good indication that Niven could write not only science fiction but also fantasy. Although, if you think about it, this is sort of fantasy with a scientific bent in terms of using up a resource. It was very well done.
His works are always clever, and they may not be the world's greatest writing, and the characterizations can be pretty wooden. But he never left you without bringing you an interesting idea or two, I thought.
Well, it was always a situation where there was something interesting in it. And he didn't write dull stories.
Never wrote a dull story in his life.
Not high class in terms, as you say, in terms of literary content, but the stories were... stories are certainly worth reading.
Mm.
Now, the last one before we get to the winner is Passengers by Robert Silverberg, who was a guest of honor at this convention. This is from Orbit 4. It is a short story. The Passengers are another alien race who have arrived on Earth several years ago. And they randomly inhabit people's bodies for up to several days. They just take them over and just use them for whatever they want. And when a passenger leaves, the person wakes up with little to no recollection of what have occurred during that period. So this is a story about free will and determinism. You might say it's anti-communism, perhaps. Though you could read it as anti-media mind control, if you really wanted to go down that sort of line. You could use it as a metaphor for just about anything. But that's a very interesting story. And, again, another nice little twist on this sort of idea. So those are the four... nominees before we get to the winner. So that's Deeper Than Darkness by Bamford, Winter's King by Ursula K. Le Guin, Not Long Before the End by Larry Niven, and Passengers by Robert Silverberg. But the winner was Time Considered as a Helix of Semi-Precious Stones by Samuel R. Delaney. This is a novelette. Now, the interesting thing about this particular story is that it was first published in New Worlds, December 1968. And... I actually had it as the best story for the 1969 Hugo Awards, but because it wasn't published in North America, it was published in New Worlds, at the time in 1968 and in early 1969, a lot of Americans, North Americans, were not seeing it at all or were seeing it late. And so it was picked up in one of the year's best collections, either Merrill or, Merrill probably finished by then, Walheim Carr, I think, who published it in 1969. And therefore, it had a much wider publication in North America and was more widely available. And so it was nominated. And because it hadn't been nominated previously, I guess... It was allowed to stand. These days, as I think we've discussed in the past, David, that if a novel or short story or a piece of work is published in a country that is not readily available, but then becomes readily available later on, the administrators can allow that work to appear on the Hugo ballot if it gets enough nominations. in a later year. So that, for example, if you had a short story that was published in Malaysia in 2020, but didn't really become available in an English translation until 22, it may appear on this year's ballot. Or it may have appeared in English in a very small magazine in Malaysia that nobody saw, but wasn't were widely available. But then if it was later on, it was published in a collection that everybody read and thought this was absolutely fantastic, or it was reprinted in an American prozine, it may then well appear on the ballot. Anyway, so Samuel R. Delaney's story appeared firstly in December 1968, should really have been eligible for the 69 Hugos, wasn't, therefore it was held over to the 1970s. Now, this short story, or novelette rather, sorry, it's a novelette, not a short story, but this novelette is Delaney's futuristic vision of holographic information storage. And this allows interplanetary special services to discover and predict everything a suspect has done or will be doing in the sometime in the future. This is based on the idea that a person's DNA presets all of their entire life, and that if you know how to read it, you can work your way through it, and you can work it out from a single test in the present. So it's an interesting, very interesting story based around this career criminal who's been followed by the interplanetary special services, who are trying to track him down as he changes his identity to try to evade them, and basically tries to make his money by undertaking criminal activities. It's a very, very good and very, very interesting story. The semi-precious stones come into the story as a sort of password or passkey between different criminal groups, and so that every 30 days the password changes to another semi-precious stone. And as this story goes along, you get a different stone appearing in each of the different sections. That gives you sort of the idea that the story is told over a period of about 12 months or so. But Delaney, not only does he come up with great titles, but he also writes some very, very interesting stories. Sometimes they're a bit hit and miss. This one was a hit. And I think that it really did deserve to win this award. I thought it needed to deserve to win the award previously, but didn't. If this had not won the award, I would really have gone for Witter's King by Le Guin. But there is the point that something a bit later on. No, but anyway, I think Witter's King was really an excellent.
I haven't actually read it, to be honest. I must go find it.
Oh, no, it's quite short. It's quite short.
Yeah, let's go find it.
It's quite interesting. And in fact, I just read her very last story, Firefly, just the other day. A friend of mine lent me his copy of Paris Review that it was published in 2018. Oh, wow. That's a wonderful story. Mm. Absolutely spectacular, but it just didn't get enough. Coverage elsewhere. It was picked up by for a couple of best of the years and appeared on the Locus recommended list, but I hadn't read it until now, so because I hadn't been able to track down a copy. Now, so what else could possibly have been on the list, you might ask?
We might ask.
Well, the so now don't forget that we have at this time the Nebula Awards, which are giving out awards in the categories of both short story and novelette. And so we've got a bunch of extra stories which might have appeared in this category if they'd fitted. The short story nominees, Nebula short stories nominees not on the Hugo shortlist were Shattered Like a Glass Goblin by Harlan Ellison. Yeah, not a great story, I don't think. The Man Who Learned Loving by Theodore Sturgeon. Don't know it. And The Last Flight of Dr. Arne by James Tiptree Jr. Another one, I don't know. The Nebula novelette nominees not on the shortlist, Nine Lives by Ursula K. Le Guin, and The Big Flash by Norman Spinrad. Other short stories which might have appeared, people have really liked from that particular year, were the Brian Aldiss short story, Super Toys Last All Summer Long. Do you know why that's important, David? that was the basis for the Spielberg film AI.
Right. There
So that
you
was
go.
that one. Larry Niven, Get a Horse. Sundance by Robert Silverberg. And another Tiptree short story, The Snows Are Melted, The Snows Are Gone. Tiptree was coming into her own around about this time. So those are the nominees and the winner for the short story category, which, as I said, includes novelettes. I think Time Considered as a Helix of Semi-Precious Stones is probably the best of the bunch of the ones that I have read in this particular category. So I don't have any problem about them choosing that one. That seems like a pretty good guess, or pretty good selection. Have you read this one, David?
No.
You're going to have to fix that. You're just certainly going to have to fix that. All right, so we'll move on to the novella. Now, as you recall, this is anything over, what are we figuring out? It was anything over about 25,000, 30,000 words, something like that. Short novels, basically. Some of these I've read, some that I haven't. And so I can only give you details about things that I've read. So I'm sorry about that. The first of them that is was nominated was We All Die Naked by James Blish. I don't know this one at all. I haven't read it, so I can't help you. Second one is A Boy and His Dog by Harlan Ellison, which won the Nebula Award for Best Novella. Now, this one I have read and I did enjoy. And to come back to the first piece, well, one of the pieces of news that I gave earlier in the podcast about Cormac McCarthy, Harlan Ellison was reported to be absolutely livid when he read The Road because he thought it was a rip-off of this particular story, A Boy and His Dog. This is a post-apocalyptic story after there's been some sort of world-ending catastrophe of some sort, where the number of humans on the Earth is diminished greatly, and a boy and his telepathic dog try to survive in this particular world. And in the end, the boy realizes that his dog's far more important to him than just about anybody else, and so certain decisions are made based on that realization in the
Okay.
story. That's a good one. I think this is one of Ellison's better ones, and he can be flashy and not get very far, but I think this is probably one of the longest science fiction or genre stories that he wrote, and is one of his better ones, in my view. The next on the list, Dramatic Mission by Anne McCaffrey out of Analogue. This is part of the author's Ship Who Sang series, not one that I've read, but I quite like the Ship Who Sang stories. This is the idea of a spaceship which has a downloaded consciousness of a disabled woman placed within the spaceship in order for her. She was going to die, and they believed that the best thing for her was to move the whole of the physical cortex or to download the consciousness into the spaceship. Can't remember exactly whether it's a physical process or whether it's just a sort of a software. Into a spaceship so that she can continue on and be able to live a happy life doing something completely different. Good stories, actually. I really quite enjoyed them. And the last of the novellas, To Jerusalem, which is obviously a take on Jerusalem, by Robert Silverberg. Now, this is the third in a trilogy of novellas that Silverberg wrote over 1968 and 69, following Night Wings, which was from 1968, which was the Hugo winner for that particular year, which was enjoyable and I liked
That
that,
wasn't bad.
and Paris Way from 1968. The three of these were collected into a single fix-up novel called Night Wings, which came out a year or two later. And it's another post-apocalyptic world where everybody works for particular guilds. And you have particular talents that fit to these guilds, but it's a Yeah, there's a lot of post-apocalyptic stuff going on around about 1969, and I think that that may well have been because of the threat of nuclear war that
Yeah,
was
middle of
around
Cold War,
continuously. Everybody thought that, well, I'm going to be writing something that's going to happen in about the next 4 or 5 years, so I better get onto it and better get onto it quickly. So anyway, so there's the four nominees for novella, and so we come to the winner for this particular category, and that is Ship of Shadows by Fritz Leiber from Fantasy and Science Fiction, July 1969. Now, the reason why I've particularly pointed out that this is from Fantasy and Science Fiction, July 1969, is that that was a special Fritz Leiber issue with a mock-up drawing of the author on the cover, and his major story here, Ship of Shadows, which is a novella in that particular issue, plus an appreciation of the author by Judith Merrill, and a few other bits and pieces about the author as well. So, Fantasy and Science Fiction used to do this occasionally. They did a Poul Anderson, Theodore Sturgeon, they did Asimov. Special issues. I'm not sure how many others they did, but there was probably only about half a dozen over the journey. Not a bad idea, and I think they generally asked the author to write a well, just to let themselves go and just write whatever they wanted. So almost in the almost like Dangerous Visions, the Dangerous Visions anthologies by edited by Harlan Ellison, same sort of license that they were given. And that's very much what happens here in this particular story, in that this is the main character here, Spar, is a half-deaf, half-blind alcoholic barman at the Bat Rack, which is a bar on an interstellar spaceship called Windrush. We don't really know it at the time, but it sort of gives the impression that this might be a very, very long journey here, where the crew and the passengers are sort of split apart. The crew seems to be handling the running of the ship quite nicely, but the passengers are sort of fairly degenerated. Because also resident on this ship, apart from the crew, are a talking cat, intelligent talking cat, witches, vampires, and zombies. And Spar is just trying to survive his journey and get through from one thing to the other, though. Spar's just trying to survive the journey, though he and the rest of the passengers really don't know what the journey may entail, where they're going, or doesn't really impact them at all. This is a very strange mix match of a whole lot of different sort of sub-genres of fantasy, horror, and SF jumping from between the three of them. And it's really sort of like an exercise where the author is trying to unsettle the reader, which it certainly does. I think you'll either like or really not terribly like this one. I'm a bit more ambivalent about it. I didn't really go for this one terribly much. I don't think it's the best of Leiber's work. I can see that he's handled it very well, but it starts off in one way and sort of ends in a fairly grisly end piece that then turns out to be a bit mundane, really, in the end, which is a bit disappointing. But it's very hard to get into at the first bit because there's lots of jargon and it jumps around all over the place and it takes a little while for it to settle down. But anyway, it won the Hugo Award, and the boy and his dog won the Nebula Award in this particular category. Interesting story, but anyway. Now, other possible nominees for this particular category might have been Probable Cause by Charles Harness from Orbit 4. This was nominated for the Nebula but didn't appear on the Hugo shortlist. And other possible shortlist nominees for that particular year, Half Past Human by T.J. Bass, which was later turned into a novel. The Organ Leggers by Larry Niven, yet another of his interesting little stories about a time when transplantation of organs becomes very easy and very popular, and
people make a lot of money by shifting organs around so that people can have them transplanted. And, of course, you know where they're basically picking them up from.
Mm.
And the other one is Your Haploid Heart by James Tiptree Jr. Tiptree's starting to crop up all over the place here. So you can start seeing a slight change here. Gwyn's starting to pick up her work, and you're starting to see a bit more of that coming onto the ballot. You're starting to see Tiptree sort of butting up against the ballots as well. Niven starting to come into his own. I mean, he won the short story award in 69 for Neutron Star, and was it 67? Might have been 67. So he's basically been picking up. Ellison's still there, of course. Silverberg keeps on cropping up continuously all the way right through. And Fritz Leiber, who's been around for 30 years, but he's still churning out interesting. I'll say it's nothing less than interesting. It may not necessarily be the story that you might enjoy all that well, but it is certainly interesting. And so those are the short fiction categories for this particular year, David.
Hmm.
So hopefully there's a few stories there that people would like to get onto and have a bit of a look at.
Indeed.
So, moving on to the novel.
The novels.
Well, and I think you're starting us off.
I'm going to start us off. Okay. Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to start with Macroscope by Piers Anthony. Now, I have to start with a confession, Perry. I didn't actually read this book. At least I didn't read all of it. I don't know how many words it is, but it felt like a very long book. And about halfway through, maybe a little more, I started flipping pages, you know, flip, 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 trying to get back to what seemed to be the main core of the story. And eventually I reached the point where I just gave up and I was skimming through, glancing at pages here and there to see if it had gotten any better. It hadn't. And then I found myself at the end of the book and I read the last page. No joy there either. So of the five novels nominated for the 1970 Hugo, this one definitely ranked last for me. But let me at least give you an outline of the story and an indication of why I found it so unreadable. So we start with a young man called Ivo, and he's of mixed race with darkish skin. And as the novel opens, he's being followed. He's being followed by a white cook, you know, a white guy. Big, burly white guy. And the setting is of some American town or city, and the time is meant, I guess, to be in the late 1980s or 1990s. In other words, a few decades in the future from when the book was written. Now, Ivo is scared that this guy following him means him harm. You know, he thinks maybe he's being targeted because of the color of his skin. It turns out that he's wrong about that, but there's lots of completely unnecessary mystery about what's going on. As Ivo is driven to Cape Kennedy and then shot off in a Saturn V rocket to meet up with someone in space that he used to know called Brad, who was aboard a space station housing a fantastic instrument called the Macroscope. Now, I use the word fantastic advisedly because due to some hand-wavy scientific nonsense, the Macroscope can see into the universe without paying any regard to the inverse square law and can thus see an incredible detail. Again, I use the word incredible advisedly, objects hundreds of light years away. Solid objects don't block it either. So if they turn it down onto the Earth, they can clearly see the print on a book someone is reading inside a library. The Macroscope apparently can also adjust to match the rotation speed of the Earth while it does this. And gosh, wow, they can even do the same for civilizations on planets orbiting other stars and so read alien books. Wow. So the scientists operating this have also discovered that there's an equivalent of galactic radio stations broadcasting knowledge using the same technology on wavelength or whatever you like to call it, on which the Macroscope operates. Now, one of these stations or channels has become known as the Destroyer, because if you're intelligent enough to understand it and listen to it for a little while and understand it, it fries your brain. Less smart people are safe from it, it seems. Now, then there's a lot of political goings on. Brad and a senator have this sort of, you know, masculine showdown, and they both decide they're going to go listen to the Destroyer and convince that they're going to conquer it and be okay. But no, both of them get their brains fried. Ivo and a bunch of others hijack the microscope and head off for the planet Neptune. There, Ivo is able to safely tap into the galactic radio channels, and they discover amazing technology which lets them leave the solar system entirely and make huge, many light-year jumps through space in an instant from where they can look back at the Earth through the macroscope. So the macroscope can see this perfect, the Earth perfectly, in absolute detail, every last detail of every speck of dust. But, of course, they're now hundreds of light-years, in fact, thousands of light-years away from Earth now, and so they're looking back at the Earth as it was thousands of years ago. And so they're seeing back into time. And then there's a long, this is where I started skipping, there's a long, boring segment where Ivo is projected back somehow to live in ancient Tyre. Anyway, and I haven't even mentioned the huge slab of the book, which appears to be based on the idea that astrology really works. And it's all tied up with the destroyer. No, that's just where I just gave it away. I couldn't cope with any more of it. So sorry, Piers Anthony, but this was not a hit for me.
Oh dear. Does not sound terribly good. He'd previously been nominated for a book called Chithon, which you didn't like either, did you?
I just don't like his writing.
Yeah, he's. I don't know why he was popular, but there we go. He turned later on to fantasy novels, didn't he? The Xanth.
I think so. I never read any more of his stuff. Yeah.
He's probably still writing them. I'm not sure.
I don't know if he's still around.
Yeah, if he's still around, he probably is. I don't know. Yeah. I'll be looking at the nominee Up the Line by Robert Silverberg. Now, this is a time travel novel which concerns a gentleman by the name of Judd Elliott. Now, Judd's a time courier charged with escorting groups of tourists back in time, that's up the line, to witness momentous occasions in history. His job is to act as both guide and escort, ensuring that all the tourists get their money's worth without impacting the timeline in any major way. Of course, they're going to impact it a bit just by being there, but small changes have a tendency to work themselves out, theoretically. Now, Elliot's period of expertise, because he's been employed as a time courier because he has some historical expertise, is the 6th century Byzantium. And his first forays into that period provide the reader with some interesting material about its major events and characters. So, you know, Silverberg's obviously done a fair bit of research in this area, so he's going to give it to you. Mm-hmm. But he handles it pretty well. It's not a big info dump. It's sort of fits in, you know, and, you know, Elliot's explaining to the tourists about what's going on and giving them sort of high-level detail, which is what you get as well. You don't get, you know, massive amounts. That's pretty good from that perspective. So everything's ticking along quite nicely. Now, before long, though, it becomes obvious that both Silverberg and his character, Elliot, are really only interested in fornicating their way through history. There hardly seems to be a female character anywhere in the novel, either tourist or historical figure, that his time travel doesn't attempt to have it off with. Just everybody. And this was his relentless pursuit of the male sexual fulfillment soon becomes very tiresome and tends to overshadow what might have been a very intriguing examination of time travel paradoxes and the means of reversing them. This is not Silverberg's book, best book by a long streak. There's a really interesting time travel novel going on in here. But he just too much of the, you know, he's an intelligent man and he can see what he wants to do, but he's only been back twice to back in time and he's already bored with the job, and you know, he just basically just looks for sexual gratification everywhere, and it becomes tiresome, really, really tiresome. So unfortunately, I don't know why this was. A lot of people have liked this book, but reading it now, looking at it from this particular perspective, even looking back at it back then, you know, there's a sequence where he has a description of a very young, almost prepubescent, naked girl, which is basically cringeworthy at this point. And you know, anyway. No, not his best. Not the best on this list either.
No, that's right. I think I enjoyed it a little more than you did, but I agree with all your criticisms of it. And but as you say, there's some, you know, kind of interesting stuff with the time travel paradoxes, although they got a bit confusing. And it wasn't great by any means. All right, so I'm going to roll on to Bug Jack Baron by Norman Spinrad. Now, like Macroscope, this one set a few decades, into the future from when the book was written. Let's say it's set at the start of the 21st century. And this one, Spinrad seems to have felt that the way to write trendy, new wavy science fiction comes down to using a lot of swear words, describing sexual intercourse in gross detail, and having lots of long stream of consciousness passages, as if James Joyce hadn't done all of that in the 1920s in Ulysses. Anyway, so much for the writing style, which I find very irritating. Let's get on to the story. So, the book's titular protagonist is one Jack Baron. He's the host of a hugely popular weekly television show called Bug Jack Baron. The idea being that viewers can call him with some topic that they're incensed about and bug Jack Baron about it, who will then proceed to bug everybody else. So Baron positions himself as the saviour of the common man or woman. He's the speaker for the common man. He's on their side, despite, of course, being filthy rich and as cynical as hell. He boasts of the size of his audience, 100 million people. And the whole thing is eerily prescient of the kind of television show run by men like Tucker Carlson on Fox News. Anyway, it seems that Jack Baron wasn't always this kind of character. In the past, he was a left-wing progressive, friends with black leaders like Lucas Green, who is now the governor of Mississippi, and he was deeply in love with his wife Sarah, who joined in his progressive dreams. But 6 years ago, he started his television show, and as far as Lucas and Sarah are concerned, he sold out to the man. Sarah left him, but it appears that Jack can't let her go, and as a substitute, he has lots of sex with a series of women who mean nothing to him, although he frequently annoys them by calling out Sarah's name at the moment of climax. The actual plot of the novel comes from Baron's interactions on screen and in real life with a man called Benedict Howards. Now, Howards operates a hugely profitable outfit called the Foundation for Human Immortality, which for a hefty fee is freezing human bodies in perpetuity with the hope that one day science will have advanced enough to thaw them out and fix whatever was wrong with them. And this was a common SF trope of the time. I think I even wrote a story like that myself. They're also working on actual immortality treatments which will stop human aging forever, but they claim to have made no progress with that as yet. Now, Baron infuriates Howards by running segments critical of the Foundation on his show and doubling down when Howards objects. And this prompts Howards to develop a cunning plan, bribe Baron with enough goodies that he'll join Howard's cause and help him get a law passed through Congress, which will give the Foundation an effective monopoly. But what would be enough of a bribe to do this? Baron is, after all, rich. Well, there's a free freezer contract for a start. And Howard engineers it that Sarah, Baron's estranged wife, comes back to him on condition that she would get him to agree to do Howard's bidding. And her bribe for her to do this, another free freezer contract. So the fear of death is described over and over again as a motivating factor controlling the behaviour of all of the major characters, in Howard's case to an obsessive degree. Now then we go one step further, because it seems that behind the scenes the Foundation has developed an effective immortality treatment, but that fact and how it works is a deep secret. So offering true immortality to Jack and Sarah is, it seems, the ultimate bribe, and one they eventually both agree to take. However, there's an ugly secret behind how the treatment works. This ugly secret, by the way, you can see coming a mile away. It's very easy to see. So this treatment is so ugly that the knowledge of it will be enough, Howards is certain, to force Jack and Sarah into doing his bidding after they have first unknowingly had the treatment before being told. But he doesn't really know Jack Baron after all, does he? Ha ha. Look, this was all, it was readable enough, but it's a book which is very much set in the thinking and culture of the late 1960s, and it hasn't, to me, aged very well at all. What did you think of it?
I'd agree. I think the interesting thing about it is that Jack Baron sort of is a precursor, as you say, to a forecaster, to sort of Pete Tucker Carlson. And the fact that because he has a carrot of the presidency of the United States dangled in front of him, I had a feeling that there might have been a bit of the old Donald Trump's thrown in there as well.
Yeah.
So you get this idea that, the idea that they start off with a sort of left-wing approach to life, but money and fame moves them over to right-wing, really is an indicator of Fox News in a lot of ways.
Mm.
And so from that perspective, it's prescient, but SpinRad really overwrites this, doesn't it?
Oh, it's totally overwritten. Yeah.
It just goes on and on and on. The first, like, 20 or 30 pages, he's just trying to blow you... He's just trying to blow the reader off the page almost, and so much jargon and everything's so frenetic and everybody's angry most of the time and the characters all start to sound the same after a while. And, you could understand the impact this novel would have had in the 1960s because it was like nothing else that had been published in SF at the time. And you have to give it points for that, but not so much now. It doesn't really hold up all that well now, I don't think.
No.
I don't think it's there.
No.
Anyway,
no.
Interesting to read, but not one that I'd ever go back to at all, I don't think. So now we come to my second on the list, and that is Slaughterhouse-Five by Kurt Vonnegut. Now, this is a book that just about everybody in his... And his friend have read. Appears not only on the 1970 Hugo Award ballot and the 1970 Nebula Award ballots for best novel, but it's also on the list of the 1001 books you must read before you die.
Okay.
And on the Guardian 1000 best novels list.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's also subtitled, extra titled, I think it's called Slaughterhouse-Five or The Children's Crusade, A Duty Dance with Death.
Mm.
Odd title, which I haven't really dug into, so other than the fact that there's a lot of death in this. Anyway, Vonnegut's main character, Billy Pilgrim, is in parts autobiographical, especially in the scene set in Dresden, before, during and after the infamous firebombing of the cities by the Allies during World War II. And he mostly acts as a lens for the author through which he can examine war and its consequences. Now, it's interesting to note that I think he mentions in the book, and I didn't actually go checking this out because it's a bit gruesome and didn't really feel like digging into it that much, but there's a report that there were more people killed in that firebombing at Dresden than died in Hiroshima with the first of the atomic bombs. I would not be at all surprised.
It was
absolute and utter war crime. It's not needed to be done, and it was just horrendous. Anyway, due to the fact that he's there during this act of this firebombing, Pilgrim becomes, as he's referred to it, unstuck in time, jumping from one point of his life to another, just whenever there's a piece of trauma or sometimes when he's just cleaning his teeth and suddenly he's somewhere else. And he seems to be moving around at random. Now, that wasn't enough to make this an SF novel. Then there are the sequences detailing his kidnapping by aliens and his transportation to the planet of Tralfamador.
Tralfamador.
Tralfamador, where he becomes a human exhibit in an alien zoo, which of all things. And along the way, we meet some of Vonnegut's recurring characters, the SF author Kilgore Trout that nobody seems to read other than Vonnegut and his mate Elliot Rosewater, who also appears because I think he's the lead character in another one of Vonnegut's books.
God bless you, Mr. Rosewater. Yeah.
Now, Kilgore Trout, which is a made-up name, he sort of seems to like a bit of a representation of Philip K. Dick to me, but maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. Maybe that part of Dick early days. But Kilgore Trout was a pseudonym taken up by Philip Jose Farmer to write a number of, three or four science fiction stories, Venus on the Half Shell and a few others. Now, so there's stuff jumping around all over the place here. And it's almost as if you get to the point where if you were to write somebody's life in a normal sequence and parts of it you would put onto a, or each bit of it, you'd put onto a 3x5 reference card. And then you shuffle it. And then you go, right, okay, this is the sequence you write, and that's what you get delivered. You get the whole story. And no, I'm not saying this is what Vonnegut did, but this is sort of the impact that you're thinking of it. You get the whole story of his life, but it's all fragmented, and you have to sort of piece it all together. Now, this is not really a very long novel. It's only about 160, 180 pages, but there's a hell of a lot in it.
Oh, yes, there was.
And there's a lot going on. Now, it's generally considered to be one of the great anti-war novels ever written, but it seems a bit tame now. I don't know whether you thought that. I read it and I go, well, yeah, okay, but, well, you know. You don't sort of get that, you know, sort of absolute lunacy and madness of Catch-22 or some of the other ones where it's right down to the visceral levels. You get sort of after-the-fact explanations of what goes on. And it's not right up in your face. You know, you're not sort of basically confronted by bodies and destruction. It's just what's there and he just sees it in passing. Now, that doesn't really matter that it's not one of the great SF, one of the great anti-war novels. It's got the style and the content here is interesting and perplexing, and it is one of those books I think everybody should read. Now, a lot of people are going to say, "Oh no, this is literary; it's not science fiction." I don't care. Say what you want. I don't care. I've given up that bloody that argument. I don't care. I think it's an SF novel. There's enough things in here to say that it is, and I think it is. You want to call it literary novel? Good. Go ahead and do that. But it's whether you like it or not, it's certainly a novel that'll keep you thinking, even if you aren't really sure exactly what it achieves. But it sticks with you. It sticks, and you can't ask for much more than that, you know. And it's such a simplistic. Oh, I keep thinking it's so simple, and yet it's also complicated at the same time, and it's really hard to describe exactly what's going on. Because of the way that of the fragmentation, and you jump from one to another, you almost want to go back and go, okay, how did he do that? Why did he put this sequence right next door to this sequence? Is there a particular thing that he's done? But in order for you to do that, you have to get in and you'd have to break it down almost the way that he wrote it to be able to get right to the nitty-gritty of it. And there's not a lot of novels around that you have to do that with. And from that perspective, you sort of think, yeah, there's a lot going on here. Mm. There is a lot going on. It's very... It starts off with Vonnegut, the author, writing about how he's been having trouble writing this book about Dresden. And then he just jumps into the book that he's writing about Dresden. And you sort of think, that's normally a death sentence for most things that people would write. To say, well, I can't write this book, but okay, here it is, I'm writing it. That would normally be a killer, but it just seems to work.
Mm.
And I don't know. What do you think of it?
I like it a lot. You're talking about the sort of the start of the book where there's a preface, if you like. It's not a prologue. It's a preface where he talks about talking to one of his old war buddies who was actually in the Dresden with him. And how his wife, this guy's wife, comes in and really abuses them after a while. You know, about how young the soldiers were who were killed in the war, and he promises her that if he writes a war novel, he will call it The Children's Crusade, which was a real thing back in the days of Crusades, when all these children headed off to Jerusalem but never got there. They ended up in slavery or killed or whatever. So that's very interesting. And the other thing about the book too is that there's this dark humour to it, isn't there? This really dark humour, some of which is actually very funny. This whole business of the Tralfamadorians and how their bodies work, and the fact that he gets taken to this zoo and they bring him this beautiful movie star to mate with so they can watch the mating happen. And it's quite funny. But there's all this very dark stuff about what happened at Dresden, which is absolutely true. I think most people consider that more people died there. Something like 135,000 people died in one night. One of the great, terrible war crimes. I think it's a very powerful book. I think it's a very important book, and it's well worth reading. But is it science fiction? It's certainly a war novel. And there are science fiction elements to it. Yeah, I guess that makes it a science fiction novel.
At the time, we've spoken about this, where we talked about things like Life After Life by Kate Atkinson. We spoke about the idea that literary novels have taken over a number of SF tropes, like the idea of recurring lifestyle, life periods. And there's also the point that time travel has now moved out of science fiction to become a general literary trope rather than just stuck in science fiction. This one, though, I think, with this fragmentation and jumping from one bit to another, is almost like a sort of an internal time travel, like, you know, the time traveler's wife, where people just disappear or go off. Well, you don't know if he disappears, because you don't ever get anybody else's perspective of the fact. It's just he just is in his own head. He just goes there. Mm. So he just, you know, is it a psychological problem? Is it actually happening? You don't know. Does it matter?
No, it doesn't matter.
I mean, he ends up back in the US, but in some ways you don't really know how he left the alien planet, because I don't think that's...
that's never clear.
It just later on, he just appears.
He's
back,
there, that's right.
Working in a dead-end job somewhere, and that's all he does. But, so you can go through to it and you can say, oh, well, this bit of the plot's not missing, and so that doesn't work. This bit, I don't care. Because it gives you enough of an idea of what's going on, and it's just it's an intriguing book.
Yeah, there's a lot to think about in there. Would I have voted for it above the actual winner? No, but I would have certainly ranked it second in my ballot.
Yeah, I'd go with that. Yeah. I think it's a very, very clear second out of all of these books.
Oh, it's much better than most of the others.
You said Macroscope is rubbish. Poor. Up the Line,
not so good.
I gave it 2 out of 5.
Yeah.
Bug Jack Baron, 3.
Yeah.
Slaughterhouse, 5. Look, it's pushing up towards 4.5, 5, isn't it, really?
Certainly 4 there. And maybe a bit more. Yeah,
yeah, maybe 4.5, easily. Yeah.
And then we come to the winner.
Yeah, the biggie.
Which was The Left Hand of Darkness by Ursula K. Le Guin. Now, as we've been saying, this book stands out head and shoulders above the other novels nominated for the Hugo Award in the 1970s. Deservedly a classic of the genre, and I think it will always remain so. But, as you'll hear later, I do have one issue with it, which will be interesting.
Only one?
One major one, yeah. So, Le Guin, one of the things she excelled at was world building. If we understand that to mean not merely the physical characteristics of a setting, but also the social structures and the culture of a world. And here she does a magnificent job of doing all of that. So starting with the planetary environment that she depicts, which is fascinating in itself, the world of Gethin, or colloquially called Winter by the investigators who discovered it. It's perpetually on the edge of an ice age with its seasons, which is interesting, it relates to what we were talking about earlier about the season of the year, or the solstice. So it's on the edge of an ice age with seasons created not by the axial tilt of the planet, as ours is, but by the eccentricity of its orbit around its sun, which means that if you think about it, because it's pretty much upright on its axis as it goes around, there's no division, as on Earth, between northern and southern hemispheres. I wonder if that's a metaphor. Anyway, in deep winter, cities are almost buried in snow and travel is almost impossible. There are several different nations on Gethin, and the author describes two of these in some detail. The monarchy of Karhide, which is run by a half-crazy king, and the Soviet-style Ogorain, let's call it. The Soviet-style Oregain, complete with its secret police. And the story is told from the first-person point of view of two characters. The envoy, generally I, and the Karhide politician Therem Hath Rem Ir Estravin. And the core plot is about their changing relationship. Generally I is a representative of the Ecumen, which is a star-spanning community of humans. The human form, it seems, was spread eons ago to a large number of stellar systems by some society now long gone. And Gethin is one of those systems, but like many others, has now no idea that other civilizations or the whole Ecumen exist. Generally I is a lone human envoy sent to the planet to carefully re-establish contact. Firstly, of course, he has to be believed and his message accepted. And this doesn't prove to be easy. Estravan, who has been speaking to the king on his behalf, abruptly tells Genly that he can no longer help him. Genly's been distrustful of him from the start, and now he feels completely betrayed. Now, before we go any further, we have to talk about sex. There's one huge difference between Gethin and the societies of humans on other worlds. On Gethin, there is only a single gender, not two. Humans, for most of the time, are asexual, but periodically, every 5 or 6 weeks or so, enter a state of estrus, or sexual activity and fertility. The Gethinians called this state that of chema. An individual, while in this state and with a partner similarly in estrus, can express male or female genitalia. Which gender they take on is at random, and so any individual can either impregnate or be impregnated. A person can have children of the flesh, in quotes, so be what we would call the mother of the child, or their sexual partner can bear the child. So Le Guin deals very well with this fascinating idea and its ramifications for society. She introduces the concept very carefully, very subtly, introducing us to the idea in a slow, subtle way. We get little hints, we get legends and myths. It's really quite an education as to how she does it. There aren't any great expository lumps until we're properly prepared, when we do get such a lump in the form of a report from an earlier Ecumen investigator who came to the planet before the envoy is sent, because those investigators operate in secret before the envoy is sent. Now, this genderless society is, of course, a key characteristic of the book, and it's one which is why it's deservedly attracted so much interest and attention. But in rereading the book, probably for at least the fourth time, I was struck by one issue affecting the plot of the book, which is, as a whole, a well-depicted adventure story. Jen the Eye's mission in Carhide initially fails. Estravan falls out of favour with the king and is sent into exile. Jen the Eye gets into even more trouble in the neighbouring state of Orogain and ends up in a prison camp from which Estravan is able to free him. A long, long section of the book, very carefully researched and beautifully written, is the journey, which terrible journey, which Jen the Eye and Estravan make across a frozen section of the world in midwinter, trying to escape Orogain and return to Carhide. And, of course, it's also about the changing relationship between these two people forced closely together on this journey, a relationship which, on Genly Eye's side, was badly misguided from the start. And now I'm going to do what some may consider to be blasphemy, and I'm going to criticise this classic work. So Le Guin wants to say that the dual gender nature of Estravan has prompted Eye's misunderstanding and initial hostility to him, but I'm not sure that I buy it. Here's the key passage from Genly Eye's point of view. They're stuck in a tent on the ice, and Estravan has gone into chema. I'm quoting now. I saw then again and for good what I'd always been afraid to see and had pretended not to see in him, that he was a woman as well as a man. Any need to explain the sources of that fear vanished with the fear. What I was left with was, at last, acceptance of him as he was. Until then I had rejected him, refused him his own reality. He had been quite right to say that he, the only person on Gethin who trusted him, was the only Gethinian I distrusted. For he was the only one who had entirely accepted me as a human being, who had liked me personally and given me entire personal loyalty, and who therefore had demanded of me an equal degree of recognition, of acceptance. I had not been willing to give it. I had been afraid to give it. I had not wanted to give my trust, my friendship, to a man who was a woman who was a man. And I don't get that, quite honestly. The key reason I don't get it is generally I himself. And I thought this the previous time that I read the book. And I say, I think I've read it at least four times in total. And truly, I love it. But in a book which focuses so heavily on gender or the absence of it, the problem is that Genly Eye himself seems to be so genderless, so asexual. Think about it for a moment. This is a young man, and we're told he's young several times, presumably with normal sexual appetites. And he's been isolated for nearly 2 years from his own kind, from women and men, but nowhere in the book ever Do we get any sense of him experiencing any form of sexual frustration or tension? Any sense that he's attracted by any Githenian, though many of them are described as being good-looking? And here at the most crucial moment of the book, when Estevan goes into Kama and appears to Jen the eyes as a woman, we don't get any feeling that he's aroused or tempted by this, not in the least. But if Jen the Eye is a completely asexual human being, then why is he afraid of seeing Estevan as a woman? Is he afraid of being sexually attracted to someone he's been thinking of as a man? Okay, but then why aren't we, even at this critical moment, shown the attraction? Even if you think that perhaps Jen the Eye is gay, it makes even less sense, because why the fear? I just don't get it. So that's my only criticism, and maybe I'm being nitpicky, I don't know, but it does flaw the book to me. It's a flaw, I think, in it. Anyway, despite all of that, this is a great novel, and as I've said, it definitely deserved to be the winner of the Hugo Nebula and to become the great classic of the genre that it is. So there you are. What do you think of all of that, Perry? My little rant.
That's a very interesting little point that you've made, and one that I hadn't thought of. But when you bring it up, it's quite interesting, because if I recall that time when they're on the snow and they're in the tent, Estevan's basically trying to stay away from Jen Li Ai as much as he can, because Jen Li Ai appears to him, well, firstly, to be a freak, because he's continually in Kema. He's continually stuck as an obvious male. And the very fact that Jen Li Ai is this male continuously is what's forcing Estevan into the female version of Kema.
Mm.
So, yes, I can see that. I can see you've got half that thing, half that relationship starting, because Estevan's moved to that particular point where you would think he's attracted to Jen Li Ai because of the fact that I's solidly male, but there's nothing going back.
That's it. There's nothing going back.
And I hadn't thought of that before, and that's a very interesting point, and that would be a very, very interesting thing to put to Le Guin, if we could.
If we could.
Unfortunately, we can't, because she's no longer with us. But it is a very... Yeah, it's a very good point. I'd have to go back and read some of the reviews and critical works on this particular book, just to see whether that point had been brought up and whether anybody's covered it. But it's certainly not something that I have considered before. But yes, I can absolutely and utterly see where that is a bit of a problem. The other problem that I don't see as a problem, but some readers do, that Le Guin identified and acknowledged, was that she uses the male pronouns all the way right through for all of the natives of Winter. And of course, because there's only one human earthling who's solidly male on the planet, because they all, the envoys all have to go on their own. They have to be there on their own to convince people that this is the way to do it. And if they get killed, they send another one, and they send another one, and they send, keep going until it works. Anyway, so Jen Li Ai's there on his own. So he's the only earthman there, and all the rest of them are inhabitants, native inhabitants of the planet, and she reuses the male pronouns for all of them. In Winter's King, there's two versions. The story that I mentioned earlier, which is the one that was up for a short story, Hugo, set on the same planet. There's two versions of that particular story. The original version had the male pronouns all the way right through. The second version that she published when she came to put a collection of her stories together, I think it's in The Wind's 12 Quarters, that when she wrote a preface to that particular story, acknowledging the fact that a lot of people and a lot of feminists had been very annoyed with her for using the male pronoun all the way right through, and asked why she didn't use the female one. She had a reason for it, but she said in that particular short story, she changed
the pronouns to the female, but kept the male titles. So there's that great line in Left Hand of Darkness, the king was pregnant.
The king was pregnant, isn't it lovely?
That's beautiful. I mean, it's just four words and you like, what? Okay, that's odd.
Yeah.
And of course, the thing when you were saying about children of the flesh, namely that for you to have a direct heir, they have to be of you. So they have to have been born of you as a woman. And that's very interesting. But she changed in the Winter's King, she changed the all the pronouns to females.
Mm, that's interesting.
To the feminine. So it's worthwhile having a bit of a look at that.
Yeah, I should look at that.
You should read that, and you'll enjoy it, and you'll see. Yeah, it's a good. It fits into this history of this particular world very well. I wish you'd written more stories based there.
Yeah, based on that world. That's
because
true.
There's just a lot more to get to. I mean. Yeah. When I read, well, I should go back and sort of say that the reason why I didn't want to talk about this particular book at this point was that I had extolled the virtues of it when we were talking about our top five favourite novels of all time, because this is my favourite SF novel ever. And I didn't want to basically burden the listener again with me ranting on about this particular book and not being as erudite about it as you are. But I think there's a lot more to be said with this, and I really wish she'd actually come back to it. I could understand that she had a whole lot of other things that she had to do. And you have to remember the novel after this is The Dispossessed.
Mm.
And two of those in a row like that, man, oh, man.
Mm.
It's really hard to think anybody wrote two novels of that quality so close together.
Mm. I must go back and reread The Dispossessed.
Yeah, so
I haven't done that since I first read it.
Oh, I've read it once since, and I think I've basically about time I went back and had a better look at it.
Yeah, I should go have a look.
I mean, we've discussed this thing in the past that we've said that we can't go back and reread books because we just don't have time. There's so much to read, you really can't. But there are a couple every now and again that you want to, and like. So a lot of Le Guin stuff I can go back and reread and just get
get
something different out of it.
So I've read this one four times.
Yeah, the Wizard of Earthsea. Every time you read that, something new comes up. But anyway, that's what I was going to say, and I remember now that I hadn't read The Left Hand of Darkness for quite some time before we did our piece about our favourite books three or four years ago, almost at the beginning of this podcast series. So I reread it at that time. And for the life of me, I had this feeling that the bulk of the book was set on the ice.
Right.
As the journey across. A lot of it is, probably a third of the book. But I thought it was like two-thirds of the book.
Oh, okay.
It's not.
No.
But it's about a third of the book. But as you say, it's beautifully done and beautifully handled all the way right through. And you can't think of it being coming out as a different ending. It's... No, it is still my favourite, I think.
I think it's still a great book, yeah.
I mean, I can understand and I can go through and I go, yeah, well, okay, The Dispossessed is probably more intellectual and a lot more of a political novel. This is more sexual politics. And you have to look on this as being, this just came out of the blue for SF. And I must have blown everybody away, like, oh, my God. This, you look at this book, and if you want to give somebody an indication and somebody says, well, what can SF do that literally can't do? Hand them this.
Mm.
And you say, you tell me how you can write a book that is as good as this about sexual politics in any other genre than SF. You just cannot do it. You can't imagine it being as good as this. Mm. I mean, there's just an amazing literate political novel hiding beneath an adventure story.
Mm.
And it's there, but it's right in front of you. But you can miss it if you don't pay attention. But it's right there, and if you do miss it, you've missed the bulk of the book.
Mm.
I think this is just spectacular, and I can. It would, as I said, it's my top favourite SF novel of all time. I would think that if you don't have this in your top half dozen, then I think that do I want to talk to you?
Yeah, no, there's nothing wrong with it.
You just get to that point where you sort of think, I can't understand why when I give this to people and say, you should read this, they come back, oh, I don't understand it. You go, What are you talking about? Mm. What do I have to? How do I have to discuss this with you?
Mm.
Anyway, look, this is one of the all-time greats.
Yeah, I would agree.
Let's just say that, and it's right up there. And I think I'm always loath to say to people that you have to read this to get an idea of what SF is like. Especially for young SF readers, because I can understand they don't have time to go back and read the older stuff. But I'd really recommend people read this. I really do, because I think that you publish that now and it would just sweep the field again next year.
Yep.
If this came out of the blue and you publish this next year, it would just blow everybody away.
Yep, very true.
All right, okay, so that's the end of that. But just to finish off with a few other little bits and pieces, other possible novel nominees... some of these are taken from Joe Walton's Hugo book, which we've mentioned previously in the Hugo Time Machine. These ones are The Island Under the Earth by Avram Davidson, The Phoenix and the Mirror by Avram Davidson, Ubik by Philip K. Dick. I haven't read that in a long, long time.
No.
Fourth Mansions by R.A. Lafferty. I think Lafferty is still a better writer at a short level. A Spectre is Haunting Texas by Fritz Lieber. Behold the Man by Michael Moorcock, which, of course, is the novel-length version of Novella, which I raved about recently. And Night Wings by Robert Silverberg, which is the fix-up of those three novellas that I spoke about with To Jaws and Night Wings.
Hmm.
Now, there were two books on the Nebula ballot which weren't on this one, The Jagged Orbit, by John Brunner, which was his follow-up to Stand on Zanzibar, and Isle of the Dead by Roger Zelazny. I haven't read either of those two in quite some time, but I really should go back and have a bit of a look at them at some point or other. Now, other awards given at the Hugo Awards ceremony in Heidelberg, David?
Yeah.
Best Dramatic Presentation.
Ah, yes.
News coverage of Apollo 11.
Yes.
Interesting. Mm. As a dramatic presentation, that's quite peculiar.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, Best Professional Magazine, Fantasy and Science Fiction, edited by Edward L. Furman. Best Professional Artist, Frank Kelly Frears, who was probably really flying at that point. Best Fanzine, Science Fiction Review, edited by Richard E. Guise. Best Fan Writer, Bob Tucker. Best Fan Artist, Tim Kirk.
Mm.
A number of names that you will recognise,
sure.
I would think, David. And so that's it. That's where we're done with the Hugo Awards for 1970, covering the works that were published in 1969.
Yep.
So that's good. It was a good, interesting year. I think the novels were of more interest than the shorter fiction for me. There's some good stuff in there, but I think it was the year of Le Guin, basically.
True.
So yeah, and that's fine. That makes sense. So we're done.
We're done.
So anything else you got up your sleeve there, David?
Nothing up my sleeve, no.
Well, okay, I do.
No,
I've got one more thing. Okay. I went to see the fifth Harrison Ford Indiana Jones movie on Saturday night. Harrison Ford and the Dial of Destiny. I mean, great titles. But anyway, I think of the five, I rank this one probably third best after the first one, the Ark of the Covenant, and the third one, the Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. That was the one where they go looking for the Holy Grail and features Sean Connery as Indy's father. This one is theoretically and hopefully, really, the last of the Harrison Ford Indiana Jones films. I mean, the guy's in his early 80s and he shouldn't really be making these things anymore. But, look, it's a lot of fun. It's got all the classic sort of tropes that they like to drag out for the Indiana Jones films. He's looking for a particular ancient artifact. This time it's I can never remember the name of the thing, but it's a rotating calculating device that was invented by Archimedes way back Pythagoras or something anyway, I wonder what it's called. It doesn't really matter, but it's just the MacGuffin that basically hangs around that forces him to do a whole heap of stuff. It features Mads Mikkelsen as the Nazi villain. There's always Nazi villains in it, who he meets up in the very first opening sequence of the film, which takes Indiana Jones back to the middle, or about 1944, 1945. And so they have a de-aged Harrison Ford.
Okay.
So what they've done is they've taken old Harrison Ford stuff and they've AI'd him and placed his head on another actor's body, and he acts out the opening sequence, which is lots of good fun on a train where they're running across the top, shooting up Nazis, lots of daring do, massive escapes out of impossible traps, all good stuff and all fun and really enjoyable. This is very frenetic, though. It just really goes on and on and on and doesn't let up. And it's 2 hours, 34 minutes. I think you probably need to watch it when you get when it gets on one of the streaming services, yep. David. I think you'll probably need subtitles, because yep. There's a lot going on and sometimes you can't hear everything. It's not so much love interest, because in this instance she plays his goddaughter, Phoebe Waller-Bridge from Fleabag. And Toby Jones is his offsider in the first sequence. Toby Jones, you might know from such things as Detectorists. He was also in the Gary Oldman version of Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. Excellent British actor. And he plays Harrison Ford's offsider on the train where they're trying to find a couple of objects and don't find the one they're looking for, but find something else. Look, it's just an enjoyable. There's lots and lots of car chases, but they're not, big, because they're all done with, motorbikes or sort of souped up tuk-tuks, and they're all through the back streets of towns in Morocco, because they spend a lot of time in Morocco. And oddly enough, my wife's sitting there, oh, look, recognise that street, because we walked down that street about, 2 months ago. So that was in Fez, although they refer to the town as Tangier. Not sure why they did that and why they just couldn't call it Fez, because I don't know. Anyway, it's great stuff. They have a lot of the old, instead of showing them travelling from one place to another, they got the map with the little red line that comes all the way down to one place and then goes off to another, all the classic old 1940s adventure story stuff. This is really enjoyable. And as a last hurrah for Indiana Jones, I think it's pretty good. The last half hour gets a bit odd, but that's okay. And the last 10 minutes are pretty sentimental. You can have a bit of a cry at the end of it and just watch that. I think you'll come out of it and you'll think, look, it wasn't a great film, but it was pretty damn enjoyable. So, about 3.5 out of 5, and I think it was pretty good, and I really, really liked it, and I'm glad I went. I'd actually go and watch this again at some point. I won't watch it on a big screen again, but I like watching things like this on the big screen. You get this big stuff right up in front of you and just all going and frenetic and lots of action going all the time. And, it's good. Good family show. Took the family along. There were four of us and one other. One of the daughters offsider came along with us. Enjoyed it.
Oh, I'll keep an eye for it coming on streaming service near me.
One for you to look forward to from a cold Saturday night at home sometime in the future when you want to sit down and, well, Perry told me about this. He said it was all right. See, here you go. You come back and say, I absolutely hated it.
I enjoyed it. I mentioned it. Yep. All right. Okay, you've got to wind up. We've been going for a while.
I think we're done. Yep. I think we're finished. And, we'll be back in a few weeks or 3 weeks with another
something
episode.
Or other. Mm.
Not sure exactly what we're doing yet, but we'll be reading stuff.
Depends on what we read, isn't it?
Looking at stuff.
Okay.
we'll be fine. All right. See you then, David.
See you then. Okay. Bye.
See you. Bye.